Welcome to another episode of Sitting Around Talking Movies, the Talking Pictures podcast. Our guest this week, back with us from the Talking Pictures show, Mike Sargent. How you doing, Mike Sargent?
Hey.
And as always, Bill Bregoli.
Hey, we're in my place.
We're in Bill's place in Queens, and we tour all over.
Live on tape from Queens.
And we've got Bill McCuddy with us as always.
And as usual, the podcast will be a bomb, but this time we have a bomb in the podcast.
Yeah, actually, Bill Bregoli's apartment is World War II themed with all these miniature planes and Dunkirk memorabilia and bombs that were once upon a time used,
He's even got watermelon in a helmet.
Yeah, watermelon in a helmet.
That's true.
Everybody will want one.
It's as though the restaurant 21 had a green room. That's what we're sitting in right now.
I love this place. This is great. So we're actually sitting very close to Kaufman Astoria Studios, where many movies were made, all the way back to the silent era with Rudolph Valentino, all the way up to the present, and Silver Cup Studios, where they've done such television series as Girls and The Sopranos and Sex and the City and Gossip Girl and 30 Rock. So we're always near
Cosby
some kind
show.
Of
was
movie.
Was it Cosby Show done?
Cosby's yeah. last
Cosby
sitcom was done
Calvin
there.
Astoria Studios.
You want to know I went to that. Street I went there, to a couple of those.
I was at the very last episode. I never
David
watched,
Landisberg's a never friend of mine who was one of the executive producers.
Really?
Yeah.
Cosby's last done there. Show. Cosby Show was done there.
Oh, did oh Cosby's too? We didn't know that. We were just
yes,
saying
as you just said on the main stage. It was done on the main stage.
Uh huh.
Many television series were done in that. Many Woody Allen movies were shot there.
Yes, they were.
Yes, they were. All right. So anyway, we're going to talk about it's really a bad week for movies opening because it's the end of August and this is like a burying ground. It's kind of like
people ask me every year, what's the big movie going to be over Labor Day weekend? And I tell them there's never been a big movie over Labor Day weekend.
No,
summer has pretty much been spent by that point. And the studios figure everybody's getting ready to go back to school or they're at a barbecue or they're all getting together with the family. Nobody's going to the
or they're
going to
catch up with what they did.
So we're
going to
talk about
summer.
The careers of two people that passed away this week. One, Dick Gregory, the stand-up comedian who became a civil rights activist and also a health
the Bahamian diet.
Diet right. activist. And we're going to talk about Jerry Lewis, who also
passed away. Oh, is that your impression
away.
Of him?
That was a horrible imitation, Jerry Lewis. Before we begin this, I want to tell you that I was listening to Howard Stern this week, and Jimmy Kimmel was kind of like the sidekick for the week. And he was talking about how Adam Carolla, who was his partner on The Man Show, was one of the writers when Jimmy hosted the Academy Awards last year and that he's going to be back this year. And what he said, what I found to be very interesting, is that nobody makes any money working on the Academy Awards. That Adam Carolla didn't get paid. Jimmy Kimmel, it cost him about $25,000 to host the awards. And Howard Stern goes, well, why? I mean, it's a gig. You're working. It's a lot. He goes, because it's like an honor to host it, to write on it, to work on it. That nobody gets paid
nobody
working
gets
on the
paid.
Academy Awards.
That's first of all, that can't be true.
Well, I'm just repeating to you what I heard on this.
Well, I mean,
show.
It has to be scale. It has to be. It's a union-produced show. It has to at least pay the Writers Guild, or unless they get waivers of some kind. But I can't imagine that that's when they say nothing. They might mean $410 or $940 or whatever the.
You're not going like, great, I got this gig working in the Academy Awards. I'm set for the year.
No, for example, I'll bet Kimmel has to hire his own writers. In fact, he probably, when he says it cost me $25,000, he probably means he's got to hire the people he wants to have. But they still have to be vetted through their, or it still
nobody,
has to
but
be
nobody's making money
run through the guild
working on that
but
show.
Are they getting the gift baskets?
Yeah
I think only the nominees are
those gift baskets are worth like $50,000, aren't
they? Have been, and they've cut back on it because what happened was the stars were giving to their assistants, and then the assistants were getting these 1099s from the companies for these flat screen TVs, and they had to pay the taxes on them. So
at the height of the gift bags before they scaled back, what were in these gift bags?
Trips to Tahiti. You're I mean, the Tahiti Tourism Board would get together with the Ritz-Carlton in Tahiti, and they would they'd all contribute and fund it.
Why? Because it's not being – it's not like, for
well,
example –
Well, you had to be Sharon Stone. You had to be –
No, but what I'm saying is if you watch the game show, Let's Make a Deal, okay? Uh-huh. All the prizes that are given away, or even if you watch the Newlywed Game and they win something, it's a commercial.
But there's no commercial in the gift
bag. So nobody knows that other
than... No, but if you're the resort down there and you have Will Smith and his family come, that's like a coup.
All right, so you get a vacation to an exotic resort.
There were big screen TVs when big screen TVs first came out. That was like a huge thing, and everybody got a Fujitsu, I think, that year, 42-inch. It's been valued up to $100,000. I know a woman, Jane Ubel Meyer, who does Madison and Mulholland, that was one of the companies that did the baskets and did the bags. And, you know, they literally go out and sell it like a program. As though they're selling full page advertising in a printed piece of material, except it's just real things in a bag.
So I understand the advantage of Will Smith and Jada Pinkett Smith and their family coming to their resort. But what would be in it for Fujitsu to give them a flat screen television since it's not being promoted or advertised?
Well, because they'll talk about it, or somebody will come over to their house and say, that thing, that big screen TV in your bathroom, it's really nice.
So you said the assistants had to fill out 1099, had to fill out...
Actually got them had to actually fill
but
it out.
But predominantly, was it just for the nominees?
It was supposed to be. And then when they started passing on that, it's all gotten scaled way, way, way back. It's also now considered...
Presenters, too, isn't it?
And presenters. But it's kind of considered payola in a way now, even though it's after the fact. So it's been very, very, very scaled back limited.
Well, thanks for clearing up that nobody gets paid. So they get paid, but it's not...
Well, I think so. I can't believe they can put a nationally televised show on a broadcast network and not at least pay the writers for the Writers Guild and the the dancers, let's say, if they have a musical number, course they've got... They're in a union.
Yeah, but I don't think I don't think it's like, you know, I think it's more exposure than it is. It's maybe it's like being on Johnny Carson or Jay Leno or Jimmy Fallon.
I got paid to be on Conan. I got paid to be on
those shows. $20?
No, it's like the SAG after minimum. It was like at the time I was on Conan, I think it was like $400, $500.
Okay. So you get paid a minimum.
Yeah, think so.
Well, let's move on.
Please.
All right. So let's start off. We'll start off with Dick Gregory. Okay. So Dick Gregory, started out as a stand-up comedian and had a lot of things to say about civil unrest and civil rights and social injustice, and later on about health. He was very concerned about, I remember there was this guy that was like 900 pounds or something like that, and he was putting him on a special diet.
Yeah, before Oprah, he would like intercede in people's lives and go and put him on this powdered diet, which...
And he realized early on that in order to get his points across to the public, which I believe works for almost anything, is to do it through humor. And, I watched some of his stand-up comedy since he passed away, and some of it's pretty funny. I mean, there was a great joke. He's performing in early 60s, right around the, actually before the Civil Rights Movement was in...
Full swing.
Yeah, exactly. And he said, I was down south, and I went to a restaurant, and they said we don't serve black folks here. And he goes, that's good, because I don't eat black folks. And then
he followed up and saying, I want a whole fried chicken.
Yeah, right. Then and then the KKK guys that were sitting there go, we're going to do exactly to you what you do to that chicken. He goes, well, I'm going to kiss the chicken. Line up, boy.
That's pushy, edgy stuff in that time.
61?
He was kind of the black Mort Saul. Would that be accurate?
Yeah,
I mean, he was very political.
He was, but he was at a time. He came up during in the late 50s with Nipsey Russell and
Moms Mabley.
Not even that. No, that's
Mom's
a different,
much
different
earlier.
Part of Kirk.
There was
it's
more like Godfrey Cambridge.
Cambridge. There were a lot. He came up a period of black performance comedians who were able to play to quote unquote white audiences.
A lot of that was thanks to Hugh Hefner.
That was later in the 60s. Yeah. He just helped create it, but it had already happened by the late 50s. And as a matter of fact, you're quoting him. He was on a show called, you know, as it was or like it is or, you know, back in the day, something like that.
You are here.
Right. And it was early 60s, and they asked him, and it was a black host, and he was like, so, you know, do you think you do Negro material? And he says, well, you know, he says, I don't look at it that way. He says, you know, at that point his career was taken off, and he said, you know, they were talking about getting him movie roles, and Hollywood was coming back saying, well, we'll have to write a Negro part. And he says, no, just give me the part. He says, I'll make it Negro. So that's Dick Gregory. I mean, and what you said too, I have to say, I've thought about Dick Gregory. To me, he was always about the truth. The one thing comedians can do is they can, and right now in this political climate, comedians are, you know, everybody watches Colbert and, you know, and Saturday Night Live became relevant again. Comedy is a way for us to actually digest what's going on. And I think,
it's the only way to make what's going on now
palatable, right?
Palatable. Exactly.
We've talked about Michael Moore has a Broadway show right now. Dave Chappelle is at Radio City Music Hall.
Right.
And Chappelle is doing jokes, but he's also got a real kind of moral compass message about what's wrong with this country.
Did you see Chappelle?
I haven't. I've seen clips from it.
Exactly.
And I've read reviews. So I've been trying to get a ticket.
Oh, really? You haven't got it?
Dave, can a brother get a ticket? Yeah, I know. I opened for him in Washington, D.C.
Stop.
And yeah, we go back a long time.
Did you?
Yeah. He was at the CBS Broadcast Center. And
you bought him breakfast.
I bought him breakfast.
What?
Well, I saw Dick Gregory.
Did you serve it to him in a helmet, though?
No, like today.
It's reading watermelon out of a World War II helmet?
Yeah.
That's
actually Vietnam.
Vietnam helmet. It's a Vietnam helmet. Wow.
It's like a MASH
that's
reunion.
That's a real World War II just propaganda poster. That's from World War II.
So anyway, at Queens College, they had something called Free Hour. And it was on Tuesdays and Thursdays. And they had many people that would come and you could see them during this hour where there were no classes. One of the people was Dick Gregory, and I went, and it was mesmerizing.
What year was this?
This was like, I would say, 75, maybe, 74.
And you're admitting you had no class?
No, there was no classes for that hour. It was called Free Hour. And I'll tell you.
He'll get that when he listens to the podcast.
There were many famous entertainers that performed for the Queens College students during that Free Hour. Well, one of those was Dick Gregory. And I just remember he kept repeating this phrase, pointing out. It was very funny. He was pointing out all these things that were wrong with the government and society, and he kept saying, we got to turn this thing around. He kept saying throughout the entire performance, we got to turn this thing around. And it was hysterically funny. And I remember one of the bits that he did was he was talking about how they were saying that at the time that aerosol spray cans were ruining the environment.
Right.
And he's saying, I just remember this was just, you know, I remember this for over 40 years ago. He goes, and you're telling me you got a jet that's up there by, like, you know, Delta, Pan Am or something, you know, and it's spewing all this shit into the environment, you know? And you tell me you're in your basement trying to, you know, trying to kill a cockroach. And that aerosol spray thing's going to go up from the basement, through the door, upstairs, and running from it. Meanwhile, I'm spraying half the can of the cockroach. The cockroach is still alive. And I said to myself, this guy's very funny. So there you go. It was like social commentary. But funny, you
it
know?
Was, but
well, I
it
can
was
tell you,
truth.
Sadly, at the end of his career,
the cockroach was still alive.
He was not that funny.
No, and he was not.
Going
he wasn't really
he was,
doing comedy.
Conspiracy theories.
He would come to Caroline's, a place I know very well, and Paul Mooney would open for him, who used to write for Pryor
Mooney
is very funny in and of himself. He has a great line about when Christian Bale was screaming at that guy on the set,
right.
and then it came out that Christian Bale had like hit his mother and had like hit his like girlfriend
sisters,
at the time.
Yeah.
So he goes, and he was Batman. He goes, Black Knight. He's Suge Knight. Anyway, Neil's very uncomfortable, so I want to make sure he's okay now. Are you all right?
Yeah,
it's
you're
not
looking
a real
for something.
No, I know. That's actually, yeah. There are no arms to this sofa.
Exactly. Right. So
in order to fit the
so those of you
I'm
don't,
so, I'm trying not to get.
Obviously, this is a podcast you can't see, but Bill's sofa is like something out of Pee Wee's Playhouse, and it can apparently walk and talk on its own, and the arms are moving now.
I'm just trying to.
And Neil feels like perhaps he's getting eaten by this sofa.
No, I'm just trying to.
He's just hugging.
He's
so comfortable.
I'm trying not to make noise.
Yeah.
Like,
no, Yeah, I know.
Right. So I'm trying to.
If you hear that noise,
this podcast.
I put my arm on the armrest here. It makes.
Hey, anyway, we haven't had a fire engine go by yet.
Yeah, okay. This is quieter. There's no question.
Quiet. So
at the end of his career, he was not bookable because Mooney would go on and do this great set, and Dick would come out and basically just start spewing,
lecturing,
and sit in a chair. When I say no energy, it sounds mean because he was an older guy, but he just wasn't up to entertaining an audience in the same way that he had been in years prior. So they stopped booking him. And the last time I saw him there, where this kind of happened, was I would say about 2.5 or 3 years ago. And I stayed.
If you've seen him.
Until like
on,
3 in the morning. And it was, you know, because he went on very, very late.
Yeah. Well, you know, a lot of comedians in the end.
There we go.
Cue the fire.
So I don't think he was attempting comedy, probably.
I had a black coworker who trained me for my current job, my overnight job. And we would be watching. There wasn't much going on, so we'd be watching internet stuff, and Gregory had all these stuff on YouTube, which you can probably find, and he was basically toward the end of his life talking about conspiracy theories, and he had a theory that when Trump wears a red tie, it's the real Trump, and if it's a different color tie, that's the Secret Service's way of knowing that that's not the real Trump, that's just the guy out there just in case.
Who no, but is that is true. I've heard that too.
Really?
That's not true.
He does wear a red tie a lot, I tell you. But supposedly the red tie.
Well, you know, my Dick Gregory story is very small. That when I started at Arise, and ironically, I was doing the first African American hosted film review show on television ever.
Were there any? Was Arise on your show? And I know you had a panel, sort of like Talking Pictures.
I did.
Was everybody
any chance to
African
give a plug
American
to Talking Pictures?
No,
I had all kinds of various races, but I generally would have a woman.
You're right, Neil. There's a reason we weren't invited. I don't know what it is. No, it has nothing women, to do with the color of our skin.
It was usually women. I tried to get
we're just bad.
Color, but you know, I got as many as I could. But that being said, he tweeted me. And his father said, "Oh, you should listen. You know, should watch Mike Sargent." And I couldn't believe Dick Gregory.
He was a fan.
He was really a fan. Yes, he acknowledged my existence. So that
with the real Dick Gregory, not Dick Gregory fan or Dick Gregory.
Dick Gregory was Dick Gregory.
Yeah. Wow.
So that was
wow.
That was
well. We had another tragic loss this week too, didn't we?
Yes, we did.
Yeah, and it was Jerry Lewis who was actually booked.
You'll be all right, Neil.
It doesn't. They can't hear it.
It's for sound effects.
Jerry
coming.
Lewis. Yes, it was Jerry Lewis who passed away. Was it 91, Bill?
I think he was 91.
He was 91.
Who was actually booked in the next month or two to play either Westbury or.
He was working.
You know.
Yes, he was. He just made that film, Max Rose.
He would do that.
He made
show.
Max Rose last year.
He couldn't walk. He was sitting in a. Chair, and he would for 2.5 hours tell you the story of his life.
Right.
And, you know, Jerry Lewis, I mean, iconic career, but not the easiest guy. You know what I mean?
I think the most interesting thing about him that I wanted to bring up on this is that normally there's like that 24 or 48 hour period after someone passes away where nobody says anything nasty about them. No. This guy, as soon as he's gone, everybody's like, yeah, he was a genius, but he was kind of a prick. Yeah. And everybody he's a problem. Jerry. Right? Yeah.
The New York Times, in its headline announcing that he died, said Mercurial comic.
I mean,
that was being nice.
Normally anybody else passes away and it's a little time before anybody starts going, well, but you know, she was a little abusive to her children or anything like that. Like this was,
well,
you know,
did you watch, I recommended for Bill to watch a very famous video that was done about a year or two ago. It was The Hollywood Reporter, a reporter from The Hollywood Reporter.
It's been getting a ton of airplay this
week.
Was
interviewing Jerry Lewis, and apparently Jerry was he was promoting this movie, Max Rose.
I was supposed to do an interview with him, and they ended up canceling because of his
They consolidated the number. They got it. Yeah.
So Jerry was very irritated because it took like 40 minutes to set up all the equipment in his.
It's a Hollywood Reporter or a Variety? I forget.
It was a Hollywood Reporter,
right?
And you watch this thing, and all you got to do is go to YouTube and put in Jerry Lewis interview the Hollywood Reporter. And it comes right up, and it's 7 minutes or 8 minutes. You didn't know.
Yes, no, everything
is. Where he's crying?
Every answer is no.
So the guy asks about, within the 7 minutes, about maybe 200 questions. And the reason he's able to ask 200 questions is because, like as Bill McCuddy just said, every question is, I don't know, maybe, yes.
Or smart alecky, or like he just didn't want to be there. So the guy asks him, what's your process like? Do you write at 9 in the morning?
Yeah,
or what's your, and he goes, if I tell you that, I
no, it's not even that.
I can't tell you.
No, he's like, do you write, ask me some questions. Do you write, write at 9 in the morning?
Do you write in the morning?
Yeah, that's what I do. Because these are actual questions. He goes, has, you know, you started in Vegas, like when they first built Vegas, has it changed at all? No, it hasn't changed. I don't know. You know, there's all these mega hotels now. It must have changed, like, in terms of the amount of hotels. Yeah, there's more hotels. You know what I mean? But how about from a performance standpoint, do you find the audiences to be any different now in Vegas than they were, 50 years ago? And the Bugsy Siegel audience is the same. They're the same? I mean, are you able to do different material? Comedians are, different material. I mean, it was just like, you just sat there going, what a prick.
Now, well, I guess he was bipolar.
If I was sitting there doing the interview, because I had an interview once with Paul Newman, nothing to do with Paul Newman, but, we all do junkets, and junkets are where they fly all these reporters in from around the country, and you get 5 minutes, and I always equate it to the classic episode of I Love Lucy, when Lucy and Ethel are on the assembly line at the candy factory, and then they say, speed it up, and it's kind of like everybody's getting 4 or 5 minutes, and if you're at the end of the day, they've got 3 minutes, and it was like down to like no more time. Paul Newman's out of time, he's got to go. And I said, I just need one question for this piece. It was that movie where Paul Newman pretended to be paralyzed.
Yeah, that was something about the money, take the money or something. And
he was
and
a con guy.
Linda Fiorentino, was in that.
I like that movie. Actually.
So
I did that same junket.
I said, I just need.
He was great to me.
I need a minute. I said, I need.
I got double windows.
I cannot put this package on the air. It's Paul Newman's movie. I cannot do this with the secondary cast. I just let me have one question. All right, you could have one question. So I walk in and I said, tell me about your days working with the Actors Studio, and how do you think of acting compares today to the way of the modern act? It was this question that I know would promote like a 20-minute answer.
Brilliant, genius.
And he goes, man, I don't have time. And I go, well, do the best you can. And he started talking for like 7, 8 minutes.
I thought he said nothing. Oh, good.
Because I didn't ask him like,
Never ask a yes or no question is the
right.
First obvious
rule. So if I was with Jerry Lewis and he was all irritated.
Yes, tell us what you would have done.
Well, first I would have told the crew, I'm gonna bitch and moan about you to get Jerry on my side. Don't take what I'm taking seriously. And I would have sat down and go, could you believe these guys taking 40 minutes? I would have commiserated.
Oh,
and if that didn't work, if I was getting this yes, no, sure, right, maybe, was Dean your greatest, was that the most fun? Yeah, most fun. Yeah, most fun. do you look upon your career as a director as more, and I started getting that. I would have actually gotten a little obstinate myself and said, I would have asked the long questions a la Paul Newman, and if that still was getting monosyllabic answers, then I would have said, listen, Jerry, I'm a big fan, of your work, you invented video assist,
I was just going to say that.
He
pioneered it.
Glad you're a fan.
Exactly. He pioneered it.
Glad you're a fan. I pioneered it.
Might have not gotten me anywhere, but I would have tried a different approach as opposed to the Hollywood Reporter guy.
Different approach, not working.
Yeah, that would have just kept the same approach. I would have tried different things. But Jerry didn't.
Can I ask you about your Paul Newman thing? Because I was on the same junket, and I want to know if you had the same experience. Sure. Like, he was old. You got in the room, you sat down, and you thought, oh man, this guy is like out. He's like in a coma or something. As soon as they turned the lights on and you asked your question, he was Paul Newman. And then when he was done, it was like, and he's like slumped back down a little and like he saved every ounce for on camera.
No, I didn't have that experience simply because of the story that I told you, because I walked in and they said, Paul, I know you got to leave, but this guy's just going to ask you one question. So he was engaged in the process as opposed to being.
But the real point of the story is if Jerry Lewis had been there that day, you'd have gotten a nice long answer from him.
I don't know. I mean, the Hollywood Reporter guy. I would have tried to impress Jerry Lewis with my knowledge and fandom of Jerry Lewis by bringing up video assist is in the old days when movies, they were shooting different takes, nobody could see if those takes were any good or not. They would go like, we got to look at the dailies.
Right.
And they would
which
go
would
into
the next
screening
day.
Room.
It was called the dailies because they...
At the end of the day and looking to see if they got anything good. And if it really was shit, they would go back and redo the scene. And they would go back and do the scene the next day. Video assist, which is now a commonplace thing, it's kind of like... you could just play it back after you do it
And he did it out of practicality because he was directing himself.
But he
right,
did
he needed
so,
to see
he didn't
what
invent
he looked
it,
like.
Mike?
No, he did not invent it.
He gets credit.
He gets credit for it, but he did
Why,
not.
Was he the first director to use it?
Yes.
Now, if you watch The Honeymooners...
Technology existed.
The Honeymooners, the old Jackie Gleason, Art Carney show, when they did a filmed...
He hated his wife on the show, by the way.
What's that?
He hated that actress.
He hated Audrey Meadows?
Yeah. Audrey Meadows. No, Jane Meadows was the other one.
No, Audrey Meadows played Alice Cranley.
Okay, Audrey Meadows, yeah.
Why did he hate...
They didn't get along at
Is
all.
Is that true?
I just read
I
it the other day.
That.
Just
Carney
read it.
Hated her?
No.
Jackie Gleason.
I don't know if that's
Stop.
True.
I read it the other day.
I don't believe that's true because they got together for a couple of reunion stuff.
Money was probably right.
The story on that is that the original Alice Cranley, when the Jackie Gleason show was on the Dumont Network, which no longer exists, was played by Pert Kelton. When the show went to CBS, he wanted to bring he brought Art Carney in the whole... cast over, but he could not bring Pert Kelton along because she was blacklisted. It was during the McCarthy era. So he had to cast and find a new Alice Cranley. Audrey Meadows was too good looking for the role and she was turned down, so she frumped herself up and uglied herself up to make herself more like Alice Cranley. If you look at Pert Kelton, not that she's not an attractive woman, but she's more like a battle axe kind of woman to like take one because you're going to the moon, Alice, and she's she's a big sturdy.
I feel irresponsible bringing this up because there are college students I've learned that listen
no
to this podcast, and every time we digress, they take a drink. So they're up to like 20 right now.
All
but
right.
I apologize. That
All
was
right.
my
so
fault.
So let's talk Jerry Lewis. So Jerry Lewis, I read a very interesting book many years ago about Jerry Lewis. And
was it Sean Levy's book?
I don't know the name of the book. It was a biography.
Yeah, this was a famous biography where he had...
The biography talks about the whole thing with Jerry Lewis, his anger, everything, stems from father approval. And his father was Danny Lewis,
right.
who played the Borscht Belt up in the Catskill Mountains,
yep.
and was never, never hit it big, you know? But if you talk to Jerry, I was watching some interviews from Jerry Lewis. He says that he had a greatest father, and he learned everything from his father, and he took him under his wing. But not according to this book. According to this book, Jerry wanted his father's approval very badly, and even when he made it, super big, and I mean, there was nobody. Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis were, and that act.
They even had their own comic book series.
Yes, that act came together sort of by accident. They were friends, and one night at a charity benefit or some benefit, Jerry had to go up to perform, and he did a record act. He did an impersonation act where he just
right.
mimed records and made silly faces and hand gestures and movements to these records. And he said, I can't get it. There's Jerry Lewis is here. Come up, Jerry, young comic, come up. And he didn't have his records. He didn't know what to do. And since he had a friendship with Dean Martin, who was in attendance at this particular event, Dean Martin started shouting out things from the audience saying, hey, Jerry. And Jerry came back with stupid stuff, and that was the birth of the thing. Then in a gig in Atlantic City, whoever was the singer was booked on the bill with Jerry Lewis, had to back out for some reason. And this guy, Skinny D'Amato, some mob guy said, I need another singer. And Jerry said, I know this guy, Dean Martin. And he goes, yeah, well, I don't know. I never heard of him. He goes, well, you get two things to one. Not only do you get me my act, you get Dean Martin's act, and then we do some shtick together, you know? And that's the birth of the whole thing. And then it became caught on. And there's a famous newsreel clip of them hanging out of the window in a hotel in Times Square.
No, I think that's the Paramount Theater.
Yeah, thousands.
Out of their dressing
rooms. Thousands
and
thousands of people on the street where Jerry yells, you want to come up for coffee?
Right.
You know? But they were like the Beatles of their day. It's crazy. I didn't live through this.
Well, you know what else is interesting? Interesting about their career is they made 16 movies together.
My first one was My Friend Irma.
Right, which was based on the radio series. And then they did the sequel. But they made those 16 movies, and similar to the Beatles, they did it all within a 7-year period. Wow. By 56,
they were just cranking them. They were like the road movie. Exactly. Bob Hope.
Why did they break up? Like, what was it?
I don't know.
Was it Dean?
I don't know.
Dean walked away because Jerry was like a control freak, or was it Jerry who said, I want to do a solo career and direct?
Reading about Jerry and his solo career, he didn't know that he could really have one after Dean left. And he said, he was kind of putzing around, and he ended up singing. On stage, singing, and
you'll never walk.
He sang during those fucking awful telethons.
He did, but he sang, and he said, and then he whatever he did a little bits, and they laughed, and he realized he could, and started.
Well, as a solo artist, I mean, directing and starring in. I mean, I guess this is the pinnacle of The Nutty Professor, which was remade many years by Eddie Murphy, but that original Nutty Professor is—that's a real like classic movie, you
There's
know.
So many that were classic.
I mean, Cinderella,
the Bellhop, the Blue Hotel.
Interesting story Aaron behind Boy? The Bellhop. You Aaron know Boy? The story behind the Bellhop?
Yeah.
He had one picture left in his contract to Paramount, right? And he didn't know what to do, and so he shot the Bellhop like in between like other stuff. He shot it with no sound in between while he was doing something else. He was already
it's kind of a silent movie, right?
It is a silent
it's
movie.
Sort of like he
and
was
they didn't want
by...
to release it. They didn't want to release it, so he had to pay to finish the film using his own money.
He was influenced by this French director, Jacques Tati.
Yes, he was.
Who most of those movies, you don't need to read French subtitles. They're pretty much silent movies, but they're all slapstick and pantomime. But the thing is, and Jerry has said this in interviews, when Martin and Lewis were together, everybody thought Jerry, like he said, Dean is doing so much of the heavy lifting here and not getting the credit. But everybody thought once they broke up that Dean Martin would die on a vine, and Jerry Lewis would go on to, you know, he's the talent behind the thing. From a television standpoint,
and Lennon.
From a television standpoint, that was not the case, because Jerry tried many TV shows as a solo artist, and they all failed. And Dean Martin created this new persona for himself as this kind of like tipsy guy, this drunk guy, and that was a big hit.
Oh, yeah. Jeannie and I just love those cards and letters coming in. Everybody
yeah, never rehearsed.
Somebody sometime.
He didn't want to do television, but he says, I don't want to do any rehearsal. So he would come in, or he gave him one day.
Since you're Jerry, what's the feud between Jerry and Bing Crosby? What is that all about?
Don't know.
I don't know about that either.
Yeah,
don't know about
feud that.
That
went on for years.
Der Bingle.
But Jerry had a feud.
Oh, of course.
Jerry had a feud with a lot of people.
Have no idea who Bing Crosby is anyway. So
hey, look, let's talk about the movies, because if you're listening to this now, you're young, you don't know him. I mean, I think the most interesting film he made was with Martin Scorsese, The King of Comedy. Because he's playing Jerry Langford, which is basically based on Johnny Carson.
They wanted Johnny Carson to do that.
And Carson was so afraid that someone would actually try and kidnap him, which is the storyline of the movie, that he refused to participate in it, but he allowed his producer, Freddie DeCordova, to play himself in the film. So, yeah, they wanted Carson, and they couldn't get him for that reason. And he didn't really, Carson didn't want the movie made. But I think Jerry Lewis is as close to himself, probably one of the best things Sandra Bernhard's ever done.
Absolutely.
It's just all Absolutely. About the paranoia of fame way before reality television and way before anything. And
the movie
I
is about basically, if
that.
You haven't seen it, it's a great movie, but it's not really representative of the body of work of Jerry Lewis. He's not playing the
slapstick. No, but I said the
idiot.
Closest to himself, right. The real guy.
Right. Rupert Pupkin, played by Robert De Niro, is a struggling stand-up comic who runs into Jerry Lewis, Jerry Langford, played by Jerry Lewis in the street, and mistakes his being nice to him for 2 seconds as a friendship, and keeps showing up at the offices where they tape this talk show, which is
Long
like,
Island House,
which is like Johnny Carson's Tonight right. Show, and keeps trying to give an audio cassette.
An
audition tape to him, and they're like, oh yeah, we passed it on. He's like, you're not passing it on, blah 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 blah. So he conspires with Sandra Bernhard, who is she playing like a comedian or
she's a huge fan of Jerry,
right. She's attracted to Jerry,
and she's
right.
got lots of money, and she just wants to be able to
right. So they basically kidnap Jerry Lewis. And I won't. And
that's crazy.
So Rupert could go on the talk show. It's a really good movie, and I highly recommend that. But again,
but you like Nutty Professor as like the quintessential.
I say it's a great movie, but if you want something that's representative of his work, yeah, The Nutty Professor, or you could go YouTube if you want to see the Martin and Lewis stuff. The entire hour and 40 minute Copacabana act is on there. You could see, which is representative of what they do. There's actually, you mentioned Bing Crosby. If you really want to just not plow through an hour and a half, you could put in Bob Hope, Bing Crosby, Martin Lewis, and they do 14 minutes at some benefit, which is really at their peak. And they're pulling from the best stuff in their act. And you could really, instead of suffering through like an hour and a half of this thing, you see 14 minutes and you get the idea. It's really, Jerry Lewis described it as the good-looking guy and the monkey. You know, Dean Martin was the sexy guy and he was the monkey. You know, he was just like, ah, ah, ah. But to get back to my story earlier about the father never gave him the approval, despite being the number one box office star with Dean Martin doing movies and having being on the Colgate Comedy Hour, having a television thing. You know, I think the father never thought that the son was any good. You know what I mean? So the whole
Neil, did your father like your work on New York One?
My father loved my work.
All right, so nothing there.
No, no anger issues there.
No, there's no anger. But how about your father? Did he approve of your stand-up comedian work?
He died very young and didn't see me at my peak.
Didn't get to see how funny you were.
I'm sorry.
No, I'm kidding. He loved it.
You know, let me ask you your opinion also. Last question on Jerry Lewis. Do you agree with the assessment that Buddy Love was a take on Dean?
No, I think people in this, again, this book, which I wish I could remember the name of it.
I'm almost positive it's the Sean Levy book where there's another great video that everyone should watch of Levy talking about initially the great time he had with Lewis.
Like you're the one who's going to write my biography.
You're going to do the great job. And then they
call them back.
And then they have a second meeting where it goes disastrously wrong. And he insists on getting the tape back from him and says, I'll send it to you. He goes, well, there's other work on that tape. He goes, I'll send it back to you, which he did. But he was not allowed to use anything from the second interview. So he went back to everybody that they had talked to about and got their versions of the story. And I don't know. I think it's just called Jerry Lewis, but it's Sean Levy is the he's a film critic. And
do you personally, I'm going to ask everybody this, Bregoli, McCuddy, and Mike Sargent, do you personally find that Jerry Lewis slapstick stuff funny? Do you like the movies? Do you find them entertaining? Because I have to tell you, for the most part, I can appreciate it for its historical significance, and I have to put myself in a mindset of, like, at the time it was kind of revolutionary. The Martin Lewis stuff, I mean, you didn't really see somebody acting like a man-child, I guess you'd describe it that way. Pee Wee Herman in later years, which I did find very funny when he first started appearing on Letterman.
Definitely do.
Was sort of like that Jerry Lewis character.
Yeah. Like on Speed.
But Orson Welles said that once they got to TV and once they got to movies, they cleaned it up. You know, this was, again, you got to realize the late 40s, early 50s. Martin Lewis were on the very first Ed Sullivan show. Just because
back when
the
it
town.
Was called Toast the Town, right?
Right. But they cleaned it up. But Welles would say you'd piss your pants because there was a naughty element to this. It was this man-child, but there was all this double entendre sexual innuendo stuff that was going in.
So what's the question again?
Completely. Did you find them funny? Did you find this kind of like,
alone,
oh,
not,
no,
with,
Dean,
not
no.
with Martin, not with Dean Martin, because now we're back to talking about he and Dean. No, just on his own, was he funny?
Either way. But with the idiot,
I'm not a slapstick guy, so you
character.
Say no.
I just didn't find it that funny, but I find it interesting.
I thought it was really fascinating. I my short answer is no, and then I was listening to Howard Stern and Robin Quivers talking about it. And Robin she said she never got him, and she used the term, it's not politically correct, but she said, were we supposed to think this guy is a retard? Is that the whole idea? Like, he's a retard, and we're supposed to think that's funny. I never found his shtick funny, even on talk shows where he was putting cigarettes up his nose and dribbling water out of his mouth.
Well, I'm not a slapstick guy either. That's the whole thing.
So,
but yet you laugh at Kramer.
But in
and
France.
That's slapstick.
In France, he's a genius. I never got that. Like, I never got that. They
but France is the country with Jacques Tati.
Yeah.
They appreciate.
Well, we can blame Jacques then.
Slapstick. What about you, Mike? Did you find.
Well, I want to hear what Bill thinks.
Okay, good.
I'm kind of with Bill. I think maybe I was a little too young for his stuff, too. Which
well, the Nutty
strange,
I did like The Nutty Professor as a kid. I think if you're 8 or 9 years old and you watch that movie, you know, where he's playing, was it what's the Buddy Love, the suave guy, the professor guy with the buck teeth and the
Clump, or that's the Eddie Murphy Clump. One. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, where he's like,
but it's basically Jekyll and Hyde.
Yeah, but as a 9-year old, I was very endeared to that. I found that very funny. As an adult, I don't know if I would find it really funny. You know?
I don't even think I found it funny as a 9-year old. I really didn't. I was in a different stuff, I guess.
But Buddy, to answer,
I like Def Troop. When I was a little kid, that was my idea of fun.
People close to Jerry Lewis say that the Buddy Love character in The Nutty Professor was not so much based on Dean as that was the real Jerry Lewis. Like that, come on, do it.
Yeah, maybe.
Did you find Jerry Lewis funny, Mike?
Well, you know, I have to say I'm a combination of all of you. I think Jerry Lewis and liking him is in stages. I think one, yes, you got to be in the mindset. Like if I were to like put on a Jerry Lewis, you know, besides wanting to have a drink or something, I probably would have to put myself in the head, okay, it's Jerry Lewis. When I was a kid, I do think Jerry, like Pee Wee Herman, is for kids. I think that that's really what he was going for, family entertainment, that silly, the mugging, all of that, slapstick. As I got older, I appreciated some of the sentimentality, the one with the little girl where she's got to choose the uncles and all that. You remember that one? Whatever movie was that? There's one where this little girl's
got to
choose
all the... No.
She's got to choose all these uncles. He plays like 8 different characters. They're supposed to take care of her. At any rate, I
think that's called I Don't Give a Shit.
All I'm saying is I appreciated it. And as a filmmaker, I appreciate the idea of turning Cinderella into a guy.
Cinderfella.
The idea of taking Jekyll and Hyde and making a comedy. You know, he had a comic mind. You know, and I appreciate.
And he was an innovative director, believe it or not.
Definitely, absolutely. He's a filmmaker.
And
he's
in the year 2025, the Library of Congress.
Dude, I own everything. They've sent me everything. I have all the.
But you haven't seen The Day the Clown Cried.
What happens in 2025?
The Library of Congress releases The Day the Clown Cried.
Oh, right. So we've got a 8-year wait.
Yeah.
The Day the Clown Cried. You know, why don't you somebody tell you about this debacle?
Well, Bill knows about it.
Well, no,
I know
you
about
were
it.
Finishing your story.
Well, all I was going to say is about Jerry Lewis in terms of funny. Like, I can appreciate him. I have to be in the mood. It's not my cup of tea necessarily, but I definitely appreciate what Jerry Lewis did. There are a lot of people who I admire. Who in real life were pricks, but I didn't really, you know, admire them for who they were personally. I appreciated the work they did as an artist. I like Sting.
Why are you looking at Neil when you say?
No,
that?
I'm just saying.
Why'd you mention Sting?
Well, because Sting is known to be a prick.
Yeah, I interviewed him, and I thought I was the only one that he was a jerk to.
Really?
Yeah,
no, and really, Sting.
Yeah. There's a lot of people who I
you were stung.
I wasn't stung. I didn't interview Sting. I interviewed Andy Summers, and he was kind of alluded to his.
Does it? Okay. Does
dickness.
The stuff?
Wait, 30 seconds. Day the Clown Cried. Jewish clown. Leads the kids into the ovens.
Entertains them with laughter.
Yeah, keeps them laughing
on their
as
march
he's
to
walking
the ovens.
Them into the ovens.
Yes, unreleasable. There's actually Harry Shearer, who was a cast member on SNL for a couple of years and the longtime voice of many of the voices on The Simpsons, saw the movie. And you could YouTube his comments. He's actually back to Howard Stern again. He was on Howard Stern actually describing his thoughts on the movie. But yes, it's one of these things that very few people have seen. And it's probably...
And what did he say?
He said, yeah, it's one of the most distasteful things that he's ever witnessed in a history film. You know, but if you think about Life is Beautiful, the Roberto Benigni movie, although it's not a clown leading kids to their death, but some people took
Striped
offense.
Striped Pajamas, what was that other one?
The Boy in the Striped Pajamas.
People took offense to the Roberto Benigni film about that he was playing, he made the whole thing try to be palatable for his son as it's a game.
Well, I took more offense to him trying to be the Pink Panther, but.
Peter Sellers in fill those shoes.
Digression number 41.
Sorry.
Yeah, no, but Jerry's career was. The guy's career spanned 8 decades, and he was still performing in the end. I mean, that's a remarkable achievement, and it's not like
ever interview him.
No, I never interviewed
Bill Bergoli.
No.
One time, me, Yankees in the 90s, Damn Yankees.
Oh, right. I saw him on Broadway.
Was it Sardis? He was good in that. I thought he was great as the devil. Maybe it was typecasting. But he was at Sardis. It was one of those really relaxed things where you could walk around like a junket, and just, but I had a camera.
Oh, was that the Tony luncheon where you just, all the nominees? And
no, but it, no, it was an announcement that he was going to do Damn Yankees.
I remember
And it
that
was an upstairs, yeah. You went upstairs and you got to sit with him, and a lot of journalists were just a pad of pencil, you know, like just talking to him and interview him. And it went with my turn. I'm sitting next to him on the, we're shooting this video, and
so
we
you
get
have
about
a video of you and Jerry.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We got.
So tell,
we
get, tell me,
we
get,
we get eight. Or anything? What
it
the
was
hell?
Good. It was
so
good.
So what do you ask him? Talk.
Oh, we just talked about his career and stuff, but wow. It, because he was so used to Entertainment Tonight and all the other things that he had seen, he was certain that I just kept asking him questions because I was looking for one like soundbite. And he's at about the 8 minute mark, the publicist said, you can have like 10 minutes with him. About the 8 minute mark, he goes, what are you really after? Just tell me what you want. And I go, Jerry, I want everything. I'm going to run this. No, you're not going to run this whole thing. And of course, I ran that because he said that.
Yeah, yeah.
And I said, no, seriously, I'm just want to have a conversation with you. Oh, all right. All right. Mm-hmm. All right. Wow. And then we finished up. And
well, he definitely had this.
But that was like 96, 1997.
Bipolar, but he had this Jekyll and Hyde personality where, I mean, you can watch some interviews. I think if he respected
a
the venue,
professor.
I mean, you know, he was on Conan, you know, he was there. There's tapes of him on Letterman, you know, and he knows it's a big venue and he's charming, you know. And then you see him with some other journalists, you know, now with the internet, you could dig up anything and you just see him being like a complete prick bastard to these people. I mean, he got in a lot of trouble. Well, a lot of trouble. I don't know. I mean, it seems like people give Jerry Lewis a pass. But he came out with this thing where he said that he wished that Joan Rivers was dead. This was when Joan was alive. And he goes, oh, well, I guess you're just kidding around. He goes, no, I hope she dies. And women.
Well, that's funny, but
and women comedians aren't funny.
That was the problem. Right. I think it was at the Aspen Film Festival.
He said
and
that women comedians aren't
all comics.
Funny.
Yeah.
Well, they should be relegated to being housewives or mothers.
All right.
I mean, how the hell do you make a statement like
listen,
this?
Listen, it's also on YouTube, Jerry Lewis saying that Trump will make a good president because he's a showman. And we've never
That's
had
true.
A showman.
That's
yeah,
true.
We got one now, boy.
Yeah, we got a show going now.
And sadly, the show must go on.
Well, Gilbert Gottfried, a very good friend of Bill Bregoli's, is, you know.
He hasn't called. Well, actually, he's on the road.
He's the on his way.
He calls around this time.
He used to do this great bit.
We're going to be reviewing his. There's a documentary about him coming out.
Is there?
Maybe,
this week,
Gilbert could join us on the podcast to promote the documentary, Bill.
Sure.
What's the documentary called?
Maybe.
Getting Gottfried.
Just Gilbert.
They played at the Tribeca Film Festival this year.
Yeah.
But Gilbert used to do this routine on Jerry Lewis at the end of the telethon doing singing, which Jerry did every year on the telethon, singing You'll Never Walk Alone. And it was hilarious, this Gilbert thing. It used to be a staple in his routine.
Or if you have
and
muscular dystrophy, you'll never walk at all.
He would start crying and singing it, and then every like 20 seconds break into the idiot character. So you're like, you'll never, and like he's like, Gilbert's pouring water from a glass of water on his face because he's crying. And walk, I'm old lady, I'm on your, go back to the serious thing. I can't do Gilbert Gottfried's routine, but it was just
they've met.
Oh, yeah, there's a photo when Jerry died. Gilbert posted on his Twitter feed a photograph of him and Jerry together.
Yeah, and
Jerry know he was doing a derogatory routine?
I don't know. Gilbert, you know, was asked to give sound bites after Jerry passed, and the problem Gilbert had was that his best sound bite was when Jerry Lewis said, you're loud, you're obnoxious, and I wouldn't change a fucking thing.
Really?
But he couldn't use that. He was on CNN. That. He was on CNN this past Sunday, and he said, do you ever run a delay? So he could use that soundbite, and the host said, no.
Well,
it was MSNBC, actually, but the host got really upset when Gilbert mentioned the delay, so no one really heard that.
You would figure Jerry would appreciate Gilbert, because it's just,
sure.
That kind of humor. Before we move on from Jerry, the muscular dystrophy telethons. We all watched them as a kid, you know.
It was like a train wreck. You had to watch it.
I know.
It was like fucking train. I mean,
raised over $2 billion for muscular dystrophy. Let's start with the positive aspect
of
it.
Well, I mean, how many kids have been cured of that?
Well, come on.
Well, no, I mean, I don't.
It's not his fault.
Well, Did they get all the money? I don't know.
He was fired, you know.
Yeah, I was just going to say he was kind of unceremoniously dumped like 10 years ago. It's now a two-hour show that Tom Bergeron hosts.
Well, it was very interesting.
Wow, pre-taped.
You'd watch it as a kid, and you'd see Jerry like hour 22, 23. You know, you figured the guy was definitely like working on.
See when Dean joined him on there?
Well, that was famous.
I saw that.
That was the reunion. They had
that Sinatra orchestrated.
Sinatra rocking him out, right?
Yeah.
Bring my friend.
He's a complex guy. Jerry Lewis.
And no one understands him like his woman. Oh, no, that's John Shaft.
He's a very complex guy. And
you reminded me of that. Those two references remind me.
Brought a lot of joy to a lot of people, was a huge star, and was a complicated kind of prick in a lot of moments. I mean, Scorsese wrote that he was one of the greatest people to ever work with. So, you know, I guess good days, bad days with this guy. I don't know. You know, we were talking about Johnny Carson. I want to tell you my YouTube pick of the week.
Okay.
If you were a fan of The Tonight Show.
Hi-yo.
They've started posting. You know, The Tonight Show was always broadcast in color.
And, I did not know that. That is weird wild.
And they have on YouTube 1964 shows, excerpts of shows from Carson where he looks – he's really young and it's in color and it's on videotape. And the show really hadn't found its footing yet. It's not the formatted, you know, monologue desk piece or
– First of all, it was 90 – Plus, it was 105 minutes, right, when it first started in New York?
Because there was 15. It was 115. 105 minutes.
105 minutes. Because it was a 90-minute show for The Nation, but it came on, as you told me this week,
15 minutes earlier.
Right, so New
York started at 11:15.
Right.
And the first couple of months of the show, Johnny would do the monologue at 11:15, but realized that 90% of the country or of his audience wasn't watching the show.
This is wild. This is weird wild. I've got to do it.
So he said, I'm not coming on till 11:30. Now, you could actually go on and watch this 11:15 to 11:30 Tonight Show without Johnny Carson,
right,
where Ed McMahon is just doing bits with Skitch Henderson, who was the band leader. Yeah. Doc Severinsen sitting there. He's sitting up there playing the trumpet. So is Tommy Newsom.
Pretty cool.
But
Skitch Henderson,
who was a holdover from the Jack Parr Tonight Show. And I will tell you, there's also on YouTube, and Johnny was under contract for ABC before he went over to NBC to do The Tonight Show. And there was like a 7 or 8 month period. They decided, we're going to get Johnny Carson to host it. He's going to be the new host of The Tonight Show to replace Jack Parr. They wanted Bob Crane, Hogan from Hogan's Heroes, but he didn't want to do it. They got Johnny Carson, but Johnny wasn't available for like 8 months. So for 8 months, Tonight Show kept going on. They had guest hosts. There's an entire episode that you could watch hosted by Jerry Lewis from 19...
I've heard about this.
It's online on YouTube from 1962, Jerry Lewis hosting The Tonight Show. But anyway,
I want to believe all that you've said about the fact that it was shot in color from day one.
Yeah.
But we saw it in black and white because that's all that survived or something.
But wait a minute.
The only problem I have with that story is every time I watched Ed Ames with the tomahawk throw it, the
bad
grist and
kinescope.
Stuff, it was black and white on a color show. So if that was shot in color originally, how come when they replayed it,
I have an answer for you.
Okay.
Videotape is very...
Tell us, Yoda.
The first 10 years of the Johnny Carson show, of The Tonight Show with starring Johnny Carson.
Interesting, this answer.
Which was done in New York. Were shot on videotape and shot in color.
Long-winded this boy.
What's that? What did you say?
Long-winded
this boy is. Okay.
Okay. All right. So basically, videotape was expensive, and they re-recorded over the shows. They kept reusing the same videotape to record shows. The shows were not saved.
That's amazing.
And it was one of the biggest losses around. That's why when you watch the last Tonight Show.
So tell us where these first ones that were in color were unearthed
some
from.
Some people, they taped the New Year's Eve show. They kept that one.
Oh, okay.
So you could see the first 15 minutes in 1964 going into 1965 with Ed and Skitch Henderson, which is not very funny, but it's interesting historically. A couple of guests somehow, there was a guy that recorded an album. of tunes. He was an orchestra leader, and he helped write the Tonight Show theme, and he worked for NBC. So I guess he said to NBC, since he worked there, I'd like to save this. Can you not erase this, and can you give me my segment? So that segment in color survives. So there's certain little segments in color that are unearthed and survived that guests that were there or the heirs of the estates of the guests have these little 10-minute, 5-minute segments. They're not necessarily the best segments, but they are segments of the show. The Ed Egan's Tomahawk thing and all these other early things were just bad kinescopes, which is basically taking a black and white camera and pointing it at a monitor, and just, you know, some people would preserve a couple of things.
Gotcha.
But
do we have any tape left on this recording?
But if you're interested in the history of Johnny Carson,
we have 5 hours and 50 minutes left.
There you go. I'm done.
No, that's, listen, that's your video pick. That's your YouTube pick of the week. That's a good one. My on-demand pick of the week is Chuck. This is the Liev Schreiber and Naomi Watts, probably the last movie they made, about Chuck Wepner, the guy who was the real Rocky Balboa, and how his life sort of got ripped off by the movie Rocky, and how he was a little pissed off about it at first and then made friends with Stallone. There's a guy in the movie who does a great Stallone when he's young. And I recommend this movie. It's a little on the nose, a little later in the film, but at the beginning, it's definitely worth seeing.
I haven't seen the movie, but I went to the party when it premiered at Tribeca, and I met this guy, Chuck, and he's a sweetheart. He's just such a nice guy. He was just so happy to be there and getting the attention.
Now, the movie says he got no money, and then I was talking to a former champ friend of mine, Ronaldo Snipes. I don't know if you know who that is.
Really? Yeah. You were talking to Ronaldo? I have no idea.
Anyway, he said... He said that Wepner got $7 million from.
That's a difference.
Yeah, from Stallone. Eventually, that's not in the movie. It's a good movie, and we're seeing.
Mike, what did you see this week? Anything?
I'd say a movie I would recommend that's coming out this week is a movie called "Served Like a Girl." It's a pretty powerful documentary. It's actually produced by a famous music producer named Linda Perry, and directed by Grant Hesloff's wife, Lisa Hesloff.
Oh, Grant Hesloff being the production partner of George Clooney and co-writer.
That Grant Hesloff, yes. And it's a really powerful film because it sheds light on something I had no idea. We all know that we live in an age where there's tons and tons of money put to defense, quote unquote, which means training and weapons and whatnot. But we know the veteran situation. What I didn't know is that if you are a woman and you go to the VA center, okay, they tell you, well, we only have programs for men. So there are, and this is the shocking point, there are over 55,000 homeless female veterans in this country at this moment.
And they can't get medical attention, or they can't get medical attention.
They can get food stamps.
Wow.
So the problem is that's why they're homeless. And it sheds light on it. The movie is a part of a movement that's changing things, and there's a website and whatnot, but I highly recommend it.
And is this simply gender-based that they're not getting the...
Absolutely.
Wow.
How is that amazing? Like,
Exactly.
I mean, that doesn't make sense to me.
Exactly. And that's the proper reaction for this movie. As you're watching it, you're sitting there going, what? And you see each person's story.
Meet one whose story gets any better?
Well,
without being too much of a...
Let me just say that there are women who have had their legs blown off. There are women who have been raped multiple times, can't get help. They're homeless. I mean, it's unreal when you see the documentary. Unreal.
Bill, do you have a pick of the week this week?
Oh, pick of the week. No, but I did see Logan Lucky that we weren't able to talk about last week.
Yeah, and you saw it too?
Yeah, I saw it too.
Yeah, it was kind of underwhelming, but
underwhelming. Cute.
I saw it with a paying audience and right around the corner.
Tell
here.
Tell everybody who's in it and what it's about before you debate it.
It's a heist film.
It's basically Ocean 7-Eleven. It's kind of a low-rent hillbilly heist movie with Channing Tatum that Steven Soderbergh, who had retired, came out of retirement to direct and perhaps write. There's a pseudonym. There's a supposedly female blunt name who doesn't exist. So they think maybe Soderbergh wrote it under the pseudonym. And it's basically about ripping off the Charlotte Speedway on one of the big weekends there. And
did you like it?
I liked it a lot. And I thought Adam Driver as the dumb brother was really, really good.
Very different from him.
Action comedy.
And Riley Keough, Elvis's granddaughter, is one of the women in it. it. I wanted to have sex with every woman in this movie. I will say that right now. And I know Mrs. McCuddy listens to the podcast. And I apologize that my wife isn't in the movie. But
any laughs in this thing?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It's very funny.
A lot of low chuckles. It's, like a Coen, it's not like it, a laugh out loud.
It feels a lot like a Coen Brothers movie to me.
Well, you know, my feeling is, and I like low-rent hillbilly heist movie, and I do think...
Who doesn't like a good low-rent hillbilly heist movie?
Like low-rent hillbilly heist movie.
I love them.
With Channing Tatum, you know, without feet.
Who's very
without
funny.
Feet wings. Yeah. But, I thought Channing Tatum was good. I thought, actually, ironically, what's his face? Family Guy...
Seth MacFarlane.
Seth MacFarlane.
Who is unrecognizable.
He was unrecognizable. Yeah. I thought he was actually pretty good. But I felt...
Daniel Craig, too.
Daniel Craig is laugh out loud funny.
See, Daniel Craig and Adam Driver felt like they were acting to me, you know, throughout the whole thing. And you know,
well,
and
they
that's
were.
Not terrible. But I mean, you know, so that was took away from it a little bit. I also felt there was a feeling for me that he's done this and he's done it better. Now, that being said, I had a lot of fun.
Yeah,
so there's a couple of twists. A couple of cool twists.
No laughs. A
couple of cool twists you won't see coming.
A couple of cool twists.
And it was interesting that Hilary Swank is the one who actually takes the air out of the movie in the end.
Hilary Swank.
Recommended Bill Bergoglio?
Yeah, I do, though.
Waste.
Phil McCuddy?
Absolutely.
And Mike Sargent.
Mixed.
You can wait
give
for
us a mix.
Wait for the on demand. Oh, wait for the on demand is the term that we're using now. All right. Okay. So thanks for.
Wait, one more question.
No, for everybody. I have a question for
everybody. Oh,
sure. Sure.
I would love to hear, because it brought up what the whole moment you were talking about. What's your most embarrassing moment with a celebrity, or an interview, or anything?
Oh,
can you say?
I have a great story.
Yeah, tell yours.
I want to hear one because I have a couple, but I just want to hear.
Okay. Well, this podcast has gone real long, but here it is.
This is worth it.
Okay.
This right. Wait till you guys hear this story. Oh, Neil has the best story.
Well, this is
embarrassing.
This is embarrassing.
It's this very embarrassing. We
very, very funny, cool story.
Okay. I can't remember the name of the movie because the movie kind of opened and closed in a week.
So that's embarrassing right off the get-go.
I'm doing this junket, and... Mamie Gummer, who is Meryl Streep's daughter, is in this movie.
Still is.
And so is Meryl Streep. And I believe that Mamie Gummer...
She's an artist, right? She plays like a sculptor or something?
Was playing...
Vaguely remembering this movie.
Playing Meryl Streep's character's daughter.
Uh-huh.
Playing Meryl Streep at a younger age.
Mm-hmm.
She was playing Meryl Streep at a younger age. This is one of the first movies that Mamie Gummer ever did. And I had no idea... And she was also paired with somebody. I don't know who the other actress was. She was paired with another actress.
Mamie Eisenhower?
And they're sitting there. And again, I don't know that Mamie Gummer is Meryl Streep's daughter. But I do know, having seen the movie, that she plays the younger Meryl Streep in the movie.
This is going to be great.
So I go.
You know who you look like?
Not knowing at all that she's Meryl Streep's daughter in real life, although she's playing the younger version of Meryl in the movie, I go, you know... Did you have much access to Meryl to study her movements and, you know, since you were playing her at a younger age? And she goes, yeah, I think I had plenty of access to Meryl. I go, so she made herself available to you. She starts going, yeah, she was made. And what I realized is afterwards I found out that she was Meryl Streep's daughter.
But it never came
ever,
up. Mamie never
see the movie Being There, or an old Preston Sturges movie called Christmas in July.
Uh-huh.
People believe what they want to believe. When I was asking her those questions, which were sincere questions because I had no idea, she thought I was goofing on her. She thought, instead of me not, like now you know that I had no idea that she was Meryl Streep's daughter, so I'm asking, did you have access, which is a moronic question, did you have access to study your mother?
Right. But she didn't know you well enough to know that you couldn't possibly be that funny.
Right, so I'm going, you know, did you have access to your mom? And she's like, oh, this guy's being a wisest. Yeah, I had access. So she gave you plenty of time to study. We were able to study her before the, yeah. And whoever she was paired with, rolling her eyes, they're laughing, but kind of like, Gary, you're trying to be a wise guy. I get it. So it never, it never came off.
That's great.
As embarrassing, because they thought that I was being too hip for the room, that I was goofing on them. Like, oh, you're playing the door. There's a real stretch for you. I'm like, oh, you're playing. What's it like playing this iconic actress's daughter? You know, they thought that I was making fun of her, that that's how she got the role. So the point is, I'm embarrassed personally, but the truth is,
we're embarrassed
is,
for you
is
now.
They don't. They had no idea. No, they thought I was like being real savvy and a smartass, you know?
And you were never allowed to interview her after
no,
that.
No, I interviewed her subsequently. Didn't even remember it. It was one of those assembly lines.
The embarrassing thing I did to somebody in a junket was, you all know that Mel Gibson, huge smoker and drank coffee constantly through the questions.
Yeah.
And what he would do is, while you were on camera asking your question, he would duck down, take a big drag of a cigarette, take a slug of an espresso, and sit back up. So all through my interview for Braveheart, he did that. So the first week I went back to Fox and Friends, I showed the regular interview, and then I said, but I have a version next week that you really need to see. And the next week, every time he's talking, I'm on camera, and every time I'm talking, he's ducking down and having a big... So we cut
That's
it in reverse.
Great.
So that was embarrassing to him. The most embarrassing thing that ever happened to me is Down with Love, which I really enjoy. It's
you
a takeoff with Ewan McGregor and Renee Zellweger.
And Tony Randall.
And no, playing Tony Randall was...
No, Tony Randall's in the movie.
But no, playing the Tony Randall part is David Hyde Pierce.
Right, but so, Tony Randall's actually
okay.
in the
so,
movie.
So, which was a joke because
I know
he was in all those kinds of movies, the Tony
the Rock
Randall.
Hutt, right, it's right. a parody of the Rock.
Because it's a parody of those. Right, right. So, this is... Renee... you know, you're just warming up. You're just trying to get them comfortable and talking to them. And I wasn't really starting yet. And I was just like, hey, how you doing? And blah, blah, blah. And I go, by the way, before we start, and we're rolling now. And I go, where's that Oscar? Where do you keep it? And she's like, Bill? And I go, yeah. She goes, I don't have an Oscar. And I thought she'd won for, I guess it was Chicago.
No, she won
But
for
she
that,
won for Cold Mountain,
yeah,
right?
Cold
that
Mountain.
Horrible, horrible cold. Yeah. Well, that hadn't happened yet or whatever. Well, like, okay. So it was in this limbo period where I thought she had an Oscar. And I'll never forget the publicist like in the background going, oh, no. I'm like, okay, we're not going to.
Oh, wow.
This is so embarrassing for my client. And then Renee was lovely. She was like, oh, no, please. It's fine. And we, you know, I went back to do the interview.
Wow.
That was a big, stupid Bill McCutty moment.
All right, Mike. What's yours?
Bridget Moynihan.
What happened?
She talked about, it was a movie she did with Morgan Freeman. It was a roundtable interview. And she it was her first movie, I think. And she said, well, I'm the new girl on the block. And I just brought up a question later about, well, later when you're not the new girl on the block. And she thought I was talking about her getting older. And so she kind of took
offense.
When
you're the old girl on the block.
I may be wrong about it, because everybody who was at the roundtable interviews with me said, no, Bill, she wasn't mad at you. She was flirting with you. And I had no idea if she was or not.
Wow.
You can't tell whether a woman's mad at you or
maybe
flirting with you.
No, she's been around the block.
That's the story of my life.
Is that why you're thinking?
I wasn't there, but I'm going to lean on the side of mad at you.
Yeah, so. All right, go ahead, Mike.
All right, well, you remind me of a story. I can tell you two quick ones. One, you know who Saoirse Ronan is, right?
Saoirse Ronan.
Exactly.
My favorite.
Exactly.
One of my favorite actors. I love her.
So I go into the
Brooklyn and Hannah.
I go into the interview. This is for Hotel...
2000? No, Hotel...
The Budapest, Grand Budapest.
Oh, Grand Budapest.
The Grand Budapest. She was in the Grand Budapest.
Yes, she was. And so I go in, and she's paired up with, I think, the young Indian guy, and Tony Rivoli.
The one who plays the bellhop.
Yeah, the bellhop. Right. They're paired up together. And so I go in, and I go, Saoirse. She goes, Saoirse, who's that?
Oh.
I was like, oh my God, you know, it's like, you shrink down to little size. Another time, okay, this is embarrassing. My apartment is similar to yours, Bill, where I had.
You have our condolences.
Well, this is when I used to live on 44th Street between 9th and 10th, and I had a really nice doorman, you know,
the Larry David building.
Yeah, like that. And did he live in that building?
I believe he did.
All right, 44th between 9th and 10th. And so, you know, I would do interviews that. They publish it. They send him to my apartment.
Right.
Nice apartment. They come over. And so I'm doing an interview with Fred Williamson, okay?
Oh, yeah.
Who had, at that time, he did a movie called Original Gangsters, okay, with him and Pam Grier and Jim Brown and I think what's his name was still alive, and it was like, wow, now I'm getting to meet Fred Williams. He's coming to my apartment, right. You know, and he comes with his wife.
Was he the okay. Mac?
No, that was
digression number 51.
Max Julian.
Okay, sorry.
So he comes in, right, and he comes with his wife, right, and his wife is European, and so as I'm doing Fred at the table, she's looking around my apartment because I've got tons of books, and at the time VHS is lining the walls, and I remember she kind of stopped at one and she's looking at stuff, okay, and you know, and then I finished the interview with Fred and everything, and wow, you know, Fred Williamson and da-da-da, he's cool, da-da-da, they leave, and then I go over to the shelf, and I see I had written on the shelf, again, back in the day, you used to record off TV, you know, for those who are young enough to remember when you record off TV, and I had written on it some Fred Williamson movie, I didn't know what it was, and I wrote some Fred Williamson piece of bullshit.
Oh, Jesus.
So, yeah.
That's great.
Wow.
All right, we have a winner, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, we have a winner. Is right.
Hold your cards.
Pretty embarrassing.
We have a winner.
Wow.
Well, this podcast is so long. What's the tote, Bill? Let's look at the tote board. How much
we've been
raised?
Here for 11 hours.
All right, and we're going to send it back to New York, and then we'll be back at the top of the hour with Jerry Vail. And,
it's not as long. You know, if
and Don Rickles
we
got to
wait another 5 minutes if we want to break our previous record, which was with Robert Wall 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, oh. I think we're okay.
No, we're good.
Under that.
Okay. Well, rest in peace, Dick Gregory. Rest in peace, Jerry Lewis.
Yes.
And you win the that.
Well, thank you.
The most embarrassing story.
It's a great story.
It's a great story.
All right. Thanks for sitting around talking movies with us. Well, I'm still working on getting Talking Pictures, the TV show, back on the air. Keep you posted as soon as I know something, and we'll sit around.
Hashtag bring Talking Pictures back.
Yeah. Hashtag we miss Talking Pictures, and we'll sit around talking movies again with you next week.